I am going to tell you a story that a powerful state doesn't want you to know about tens of thousands who have disappeared.
Once they get into the hands of the military, they will be tortured brutally.
It's a story so dangerous to tell that for some, it's meant ending up on a kill list.
She was seen as a dangerous political actor and a threat to Pakistan's security, but she was a local hero.
The Kill List, a 6-part investigative podcast, available now. Get early access to episodes at cbc.ca/listen or by subscribing to the CBC True Crime Premium channel on Apple Podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
Hello, I'm Matt Galloway, and this is The Current Podcast.
The ban on assault-style weapons is in place, has been in place for 4 years. We are going to do everything to make sure they remain illegal and that people be fairly compensated for something they bought back when it was perfectly legal to do so.
Prime Minister Justin Trudeau defended his government's gun ban earlier this week. In 2020, after the mass shooting in Portapique, Nova Scotia, the federal government banned over 1,500 models of assault-style firearms. The government promised to buy back guns from legal gun owners, but that buyback has yet to start. The latest delay comes care of Canada Post. The Crown Corporation is refusing to collect these banned guns, citing safety concerns for its employees. Nathalie Provost is a survivor of the École Polytechnique shooting and an activist with Poly Remembers, and she says the federal government needs to get Canada Post on board.
We don't really understand their safety issue, and we hope that Minister Duclos will be able to go further in his discussion with Canada Post. We don't take no for an answer.
This 2-year amnesty for owners of banned guns has been extended until October of 2025. Rod Giltaka is the head of the Canadian Coalition for Firearm Rights, amnesty or not. He says the ban and the buyback are the wrong approach.
For regular semi-automatic rifles like the ones that were banned, those should not be banned. They should be available should someone meet the minimum requirement of training. We have a criminal record check every 24 hours. AR-15s were registered. Handguns are registered. So if you can meet those requirements, there's no reason why you shouldn't own those firearms.
Buybacks have been implemented around the world with varying degrees of success. One of the largest buyback programs in the world was in Australia back in the late 90s. Christine Neal is an associate professor of economics at Wilfrid Laurier University and has studied that Australian buyback program. Christine, good morning.
Good morning.
What was it that prompted Australia to launch this buyback program?
Well, unfortunately, as with most of these programs, it was a mass shooting, which was the second largest in the world to that point, the Port Arthur killings in 1996 that led to the deaths of 35 people. The then Conservative government in Australia, the Liberal and National Party coalition, got together with the state governments and with really very substantial political support from the public at large, implemented a set of national level standards and in terms of just regulations and enforcement. It had been different by state up to that point. And then also had the a number of firearms declared newly illegal, as Canada has done, and implemented the buyback to, again, compensate gun owners for that.
In the wake of that mass shooting, what sort of guns were banned in Australia?
This is an area where I am really not an expert, but it was similar to the ideas that that Canada has had, that it's that handguns were already fairly strictly controlled, but that weapons that could fire more quickly needed to be better controlled. And so it was, again, the semi-automatic type weapons.
And so how many guns were actually handed in as part of this buyback?
So, yeah, it is by far the largest buyback that I know of, at least. 650,000 guns were bought back, and that was about 20% of the stock, the estimated stock, because these things are very uncertain at the time. Most other buyback programs have been in the range of 1% to 5%.
So 20% of all privately owned guns were handed back?
Yeah.
How did the Prime Minister at the time, John Howard, convince gun owners, but also, I mean, this requires the buy-in of state officials to get on board with this? I mean, the tragedy is one thing, but how you go through kind of enacting a process to get the guns back is something else. So how did the Prime Minister do that?
So again, I'm not a political scientist. I'm an economist. And unfortunately, I got into this not even for theory reasons, I got into it because of bad statistical analysis. But anyway, I was, of course, in Australia at the time. There was really very widespread public support for doing something in the wake of that that massacre. It was really very shocking to Australians. That said, there had been several other, you know, public mass killings in the lead up to Port Arthur in the previous decade, so it wasn't a unique event at the time. But the very great deal of public support was key. The states and how those were brought in, I really can't say, but it was much more of a supportive environment than seems to be the case in Canada at the moment with the provincial governments.
So was this controversial? I mean, you were there at the time. Was it controversial? I'd read a story that John Howard showed up at a public meeting wearing a bulletproof vest because he was worried.
He did.
And part of that could be politics and political theater, but it could also be concern that this would be a controversial issue. What was the mood like at the time?
Yes, I think that is correct. It was controversial. These things always are. People who own guns own them for reasons, right? They find benefits to themselves in doing that. That's economists would say that, right? For people in rural areas in particular, it was very difficult. So the biggest political problem really was the National Party, which was in coalition with the Liberal Party at the time, right? Which is the more rural party. Its main political base is in rural areas. And farmers, you know, are much more likely to want and or need guns. So that getting that group on side was difficult. And the Deputy Prime Minister at the time, Tim Fisher, was from that political party, and his support on that was critical. So having the National Party leader on side for pushing this through was really key. So I do think, yeah, the wearing the bulletproof vest was, honestly, he was somewhat mocked at the time in Australia for mm-hmm. that. But it was indicative that there were some really high feelings about this, and that anytime there is a mass shooting, people start to feel more uncertain and more at risk, right? So understandable.
As you understand it, what happened to rates of gun violence in the wake of that buyback?
Right. Well, that was how I got into this at first. There were a couple of studies out that we did not think, my co-author and I, Andrew Lee, did not think were particularly good. So we thought we should point out that they were not good. So the way that the analysis had been done was to say what happened to overall gun deaths and non-gun deaths in Australia after the buyback relative to before the buyback. And our point was, look, you can't do that. There's so much else going on. We don't have a good theory of firearm homicides and suicides, or indeed overall homicides and suicides. So these sorts of statistical analyses that just rely on the time series data, we would say, the change over time, are not useful. So we thought we could do better by using that variation across the states that I mentioned, that some states had had different policies before the NFA, but they were all harmonized after. And so we looked at whether states that had bigger buybacks, right, had bigger falls in deaths than states that had smaller buybacks.
Yeah. And do you know how that broke down?
We found substantial declines in deaths.
Well, do you know how that broke down? You mentioned a couple of different things. One is homicide and assault rates. The other are suicide rates. Do you know how that it broke down along those lines?
Yeah, absolutely. We estimated using that, you know, cross-sectional time series method, panel method, we estimated that after the NFA, if you'd looked at a state that had about the average buyback that Australia did compared to a state that had no buyback, would have seen about a 75% fall in firearm suicides and a 35 to 50% fall in firearm homicides. But that one's a little bit more uncertain just because we just don't, you know, murders, homicides are actually relatively rare. So you don't have fortunately, we don't have the number of deaths, especially of shooting deaths, to really pin down the exact percentages there. But very substantial falls in both. And even now, both of the, you can see it in the time series data that just the rates have fallen dramatically in Australia, and they're still very low.
Understanding that I mean, this was a while ago, but obviously Canada is very different from Australia, culturally, mm-hmm. geographically. There's any number of things that are different. But at the same time, this is a program that was at scale and that seemed to work. How much do you think a country like Canada could learn from what Australia went through?
Right. I think a substantial amount. I mean, Canada and Australia are very, very similar in a lot of ways, I have to say, not weather-wise, but otherwise, including in the federal system that we have. Canada's got a slightly stronger, well, the provinces are slightly stronger in Canada and Australia, but still, there aren't that many places like that, the same sort of set of laws, the same Commonwealth-type history, right? So quite, and frankly, the people are very similar. So quite a lot. Canada actually has now much higher rates of firearms used in both suicides and homicides than Australia did back in the 90s, actually, and certainly than Australia does now. So I think Australia currently has something like 5%, I think, of suicides and 14% of homicides with guns. Canada is at, I think, 13 and 42%, quite a bit higher. So there's a lot there's an issue in Canada with firearms relative to Australia, certainly right now. That said, there are some big differences. Right. So the legal system is similar. What's not similar is Australia does have a slight advantage in controlling its borders relative to Canada, especially when we're talking about guns, because the US, as we know, is not a place that has relatively few guns. And we do have a long border, which is famously the world's largest undefended border, right? So that is a concern, I would say, in Canada. But the rest is very similar.
Christine, we'll leave it there. I'm glad to talk to you. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much.
Christine Neal is an associate professor of economics at Wilfrid Laurier University.
Hello, I'm Jess Milton. For 15 years, I produced The Vinyl Cafe with the late, great Stuart MacLean. Every week, more than 2 million people tuned in to hear funny, fictional, feel-good stories about Dave and his family. We're excited to welcome you back to the warm and welcoming world of The Vinyl Cafe with our new podcast, Backstage at The Vinyl Cafe. Each week, we'll share 2 hilarious stories by Stuart, and for the first time ever, I'll tell you what it was like behind the scenes. Subscribe for free wherever you get your podcasts.
AJ Somerset is the author of Arms, the Credo Culture and Credo of the Gun. He's also a gun owner, and he joins us now. AJ, good morning to you.
Good morning.
You describe yourself, as I said, as a gun owner, but also somebody who sees that there are problems and that we need to talk about them in a frank and honest way. What do you make, in the context of that, what do you make of the Liberal government's ban and buyback program when it comes to guns?
Well, ultimately, I think that the disappointing aspect of the Liberal government's move is that they didn't actually ban assault weapons in this country. They banned 1,500 models. Then they've subsequently done legislation to ban future models. But there's all kinds of stuff that remains legal. So they're going to spend an awful lot of money doing something that isn't actually really going to ban an entire class of firearms.
Can you explain that for people who don't understand the various delineations between these types of guns? Just briefly, what do you mean when you say that this isn't the ban that perhaps the government thinks it is?
Yeah, sure. So if you have something they are banning, the AR-15, famous, everybody knows it. So this is a 223 caliber semi-automatic rifle fed by a detachable 30-round box magazine, which is limited to 5 rounds in Canada. So that's the sort of fundamental functional specification of what that firearm is. That gun is now banned, but we have other firearms on the market that remain legal, which are also semi-automatic 223 caliber rifles fed by detachable magazines capable of accepting a 30-round box magazine, which in Canada is limited to 5. So it's by banning a bunch of firearms by name, they didn't actually ban the class of firearms. And then they came back in their most recent legislation and at one point attempted to ban the class of firearms by saying anything with a box magazine over five rounds that is semi-automatic center fire. So they tried to ban the class, but they got so much pushback that they amended that. So it's only firearms that are designed in the future. There's this chunk of guns that are still legal.
You own one of the rifles that was initially banned, right?
Well, I own a rifle which was banned by the amendment that they unsuccessfully introduced. Mm. Not one that was on the May 2020 list of banned firearms.
When what did you think when you learned that gun was on this list?
I wasn't surprised. Mm. So, and I mean, it's not an expensive gun. I actually only paid $169 for it. So, you know, I wasn't as upset as I might have been. You know, I sympathize with people who own $3,000 rifles and find them banned. But to me, it wasn't a big deal. It was a $169 gun.
I mean, this ban came into place, as I mentioned, after the horrific shooting in Portapique, Nova Scotia. If not a ban, what do you think would work better to ensure that Canadians are safer?
Well, I mean, one of the problems with what the Liberals have done is they've gone from 0 to 60 in 0 seconds, right? We've gone from having some rifles that were non-restricted before May 2020, and after May 2020, they suddenly became prohibited. And we never explored what was in between as possibilities. It's as if a ban is the only thing we can think of. So we had a system in place whereby some firearms are restricted. We restricted who could own them. We said you need more stringent background checks. And we also restricted the way in which they could be used. Handguns can only be used on a range, for example. And we never have explored tinkering with that system to create a middle ground that will give enhanced control over the guns that are kind of problematic in terms of mass shootings, give enhanced control of them while still leaving some room for some people to own them.
You heard the Prime Minister defending the ban earlier. Have a listen to Pierre Poilievre, the leader of the Conservative Party. He attacked the Liberal government's buyback program in question period earlier this week. Take a listen.
I know that in places like Kapuskasing, casing, the law-abiding people enjoy hunting. And we know that while your leader and the Prime Minister look down on those people and think that they are to blame for crime, we know that the hunters in Kapuskasing are the salt of the earth. They're the best people around, and we're going to make sure that they can keep their hunting rights. God love them.
He's talking about salt of the earth hunters in his words, and he's promising to end the ban if he gets elected. How appealing do you think that message is to gun owners?
Well, it is really appealing, and it's classic gun politics, because you see that in there he has those themes where he talks about how the government looks down on those people and treats those people like criminals. And this appeals to the sense that many gun owners have that they are essentially persecuted because people don't understand why they would want to own firearms. And also in there's the appeal to hunters, right? So the assault weapons ban that the government is attempting to do doesn't actually really target hunters. There are some effects on firearms that some hunters use, but he's not going after hunters and he's not going after hunting. Mm. But Poilievre is eager to suggest that the Liberal government is going after hunters and hunting, because there's a population there of hunters who feel threatened by opposition to hunting and stuff like that, who can be exploited for votes.
We're out of time, but let me just ask you, just in the last minute or so that we have, you have said that if you're going to have a sensible discussion on guns, you have to be willing to accept two things. These are your words: that there are reasons to want to regulate guns, and the second is there's a legitimate reason that people want to own guns. How hard is it, and this kind of picks up on what you just said, how hard is it to have a sensible conversation on guns these days?
Well, it's extremely difficult to have a sensitive or a sensible conversation on guns these days, because if you come out and suggest that there are sensible reasons to regulate firearms, you are immediately met with a firestorm of opposition by people who won't accept that that is true. And those are sort of the most vocal people in the room, and they take over the entire conversation. And the same also works in reverse. If you say, well, there's reasons people want to own guns, there's always people in the room who will start shouting at you. And with the nature of communication today, and you know, the fact that much of our public discourse is through the internet, things get very heated very quickly, and it's very difficult to have a nuanced discussion about firearms.
Do you worry about that? I mean, in the absence of that, what do you think is at stake? Just really briefly.
Well, I think that one of the results of that is that you go from 0 to 60 in 0 seconds, as the government did. There's no room to have conversations about those intermediate measures you might take. And one of the things that happens as well is the government wants to then take big, sexy measures like handgun freeze and an assault rifle ban in order to sort of grab headlines and grab support, where maybe the most valuable parts of the legislation are the little things that nobody's paying attention to, changing how licensing works and things like that.
AJ, we'll leave it there. Glad to talk to you. Thank you very much.
Great. Thanks for having me.
AJ Somerset, the author of Arms, The Culture and the Credo of the Gun. We did contact the Minister of Public Safety, Dominic LeBlanc. His office sent us a statement that reads, in part, "We are working to establish a firearms buyback program that will provide fair compensation to eligible businesses and firearm owners in possession of these prohibited firearms. That work is underway. We look forward to sharing more information on next steps with Canadians."
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.